Blog Talk Radio.
Author of the book Searching for Roy Buchanan and other Brown Posey releases. Our guest today is Dennis Akinmolasire. He is the author of two books of very different subjects and styles. Love, War, and Glory, Spoken Words for All Seasons, is a series of short poems and pieces about those subjects. And The Mission to End Slavery is a tale of time travel and is an examination of racism and prejudice. A graduate of Loughborough University, Dennis is a resident of London. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, we first came across each other about a year ago, and we were talking about getting you on the program for Love, War, and Glory, but we have two to talk about, so maybe this works out even better. I would like to first begin with Love, War, and Glory. There's this really unique set of like little short pieces and poems on those subjects and others. When did you get the idea that these may make a book, or these might make a good set of like a cycle of stories or something? When did that come to you?
Well, it's interesting how that all came about. The thing is, I've been writing for a very long time. And so what happened was, in December 2017, I was at home messing around on my computer, that I came across all my old poems. And I was reading through them, all the old poems, the short stories that I did. And I said to myself, you actually never did anything with this. And I said, what if you, and the idea came to me, why don't you turn this into a book? So in January afternoon in the new year, I went and did some research, looked into what it would take to make a book. I discovered my first publisher, and then after a few conversations, I decided to go for it. Then about 6 months later, we ended up with a book on Amazon.
And that must have been something. It was when I finally first put my first book, Parasite Girls, together a long time ago, there was this sort of excitement, but there was also a little trepidation of, oh, are people going to like this? Did you, when you went into it, what were you hoping for with that initial release?
I think it was just about a combination of wanting to experience something new, something that would be with you forever, and just trying to see how far, where this would end up. Because what was interesting, that my background is a software engineer. So people think software engineers are nerdy, aren't artistic, and don't have that creative flair. And one of the things I was hoping I could prove in my first book is, just because you're a software engineer or in a so-called like office of one, doesn't mean you don't have that creative side to you. Like, I remember when I went to a poetry convention and people saw me come in my suit, and people, one comment was, you look too formal to be coming to a poetry convention. When I was reading from my book, people were like, okay, I see what this guy has.
Interesting. And how far back do some of these writings go? About how, well, you know, when did you start writing them down and putting, committing them to paper, so to speak?
Some of the earlier ones were 2006, 2007, like the man who, one of the first stories, The Man Who Went to War and Won, that was written back in January 2007.
And that's another interesting thing, too, that is, in terms of my own writing, beyond my books, I'm more of a songwriter than a poet, and when I write lyrics, they just come out when the moment is right. How has it worked for you throughout your life when you write? Is there just when a moment strikes you, or how do you approach it?
I think it's a combination of writing what comes to me. So especially when it came to poetry, it was about reacting to how I was thinking or how I was feeling at the time. Like the mother, one of the stories I wrote in my first book, The Motherland, that was written after I watched Black Panther, so there are things that are very fresh in my mind. Whereas mm-hmm. if I look at something such as spending a decade here, that was affecting on being that 10 years at the company I worked at. I was affecting our journey I was taking on at that point in time. Others are just about going through painful moments in my life, like the heartbreak one, for instance.
Yes. And some of those subjects, the way you write, there's, like you talked about heartbreak, you know, you talked about love, you talked about marriage and that sort of thing. We've been, all of us, it doesn't matter who we are, we've all been through levels of it. How difficult was it for you to bring those out?
I don't think it was, I didn't find it that difficult to bring those out, because I think the reason why was a significant amount of time had passed since some of those incidents had happened, and I was probably in a good place in my life, or in a very reflective place where I was in a great position to be able to talk about some of those things.
Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a very difficult, it was a difficult thing for me to write early on, even though a part of me is in everything I've done, is I didn't feel when I began writing I was really ready to share some of the stuff that went on in my life, and yet it just seeped in. It just kind of arrived anyway, and I thought, oh, that's me. But I thought, well, I've written it. I guess it's best to share it, right?
I think part of the reason why I write is a combination of, when I wrote Love, War, and Glory, I felt that these are things that related to people in everyday life. So I felt people could relate to what I was saying. So sometimes, because the feedback I was often getting was people could relate or he spoke to some of the themes. There was something in it for everybody. So if you're more about the love side, there was a love section. But if you're more about the everyday battles and hardship that you face in life, there's a war section. And Glory was about, okay, you've overcome all that and you're getting your end reward. And there's another section called Life Stories that was a whole set of different themes that were close to me.
Yeah, and that was the thing, like in the war section, there was a focus, I felt, from reading them, not what people would take at face value, but it seemed more like at times the battle within, if that's what kind of struck me, I think. Am I right in that direction?
I have a feeling that the man who went to war and won was definitely a case in point, because sometimes the biggest challenge you face in life can be yourself. So I think there were elements of that coming through a lot of my stories.
It does seem that way. There's a lot of practical advice. Interesting one was dealing, like there was ones dealing with anger, dealing with the ego. And I think as we get older, it gets a little better, a little easier to do that. But and I guess the main thing is the experiences you have seem to translate to your work. With the more difficult or the emotional ones, like anger, say, or having your ego sort of, not really punctured, but maybe pushed a little bit or nudged, when those come to you, what's your reaction to it, like, say, from the experience, then you get to the writing process? What is the in-between like, or is there one for you?
I think my natural nature, when it comes to life and things in general, is to go on the attack and just be on the front foot with things. And I think some of the poems I wrote were with that mindset in place. But there have been times in my life where I've had significant setbacks. And it's been like, okay, you're at the bottom. Well, how do you pull yourself up again? I was fortunate that in certain situations I had a lot of good people around me, and they were able to help me get on the wagon, so to speak. I think it's a case of figuring out what works for you, because the methodology that works for me that may not work for another person, everyone has their own buttons, everyone's motivated by different things, everyone has their own trigger points. And I think part of growing up is being able to understand what those trigger points are. Because you can't train people exactly the same way. So part of the challenge in terms of overcoming that challenge is figuring out, well, what makes you tick? How do you get the best out of yourself? Once you know what makes you tick, then you can respond to that and know how to manage certain situations better.
Yes, very, very practical. And you talked also, as we moved into the glory section, yes, like you say, getting your reward, you know, get what you put in kind of thing. You mentioned the man with the Midas touch. That was really interesting to read. I remember reading it over more than once and really thinking about it. And it was like, I think we all know somebody in that life who just seems to be able to do that. Was there one person you knew, or is there more than one that goes into these kinds of characters like this man? Was there one for you?
Not necessarily for the Midas touch. There have been a lot of people that I've admired, respected, or feel like they've got it going on for certain skills or certain areas of life that I feel they're able to do well. I would say in terms, one poem that I didn't write, where there was maybe one or two people, was the greatest ever. When I wrote that one, I was thinking of who I felt were some of the greatest people in their fields. People like Pete Sampras in tennis, Roger Federer, Pele, Muhammad Ali. So when I was describing the greatest of all time, I was really talking about an amalgamation of all of those three or four different people who I felt were at the top of their game for a lengthy period of time. So I would say that was the one where it was almost like there were one or two, there were three or four different people in my mind.
And those are certainly people anybody would look at as heroes or look at as role models, perhaps. The one thing I thought of is when I think of that, I think of certain people as well. When I go to concerts and I see certain musicians, I mean, you see professionals who maybe haven't played all their lives, but they just have that talent and they have the drive to make every note work, every note count. I think of certain people, and I've seen it in sports as well. I go to, you know, when you go to games or you watch them on television, it's like you just see them and you're like, they make this look so easy. And you just have to be reminded of, think of the work they put in to get to that.
Sometimes when it comes to successful people sometimes only see the end result. Like people look at me and they say, yeah, you're a homeowner, you're driving now, you're a vice president in your firm. But people forget that maybe 6-7 years ago, I was nowhere near close to some of those things. But people sometimes don't see the journey, they only see the end result. Like if you look at any successful person, regardless of what field they're in, every one of them has had a journey. They didn't wake up, unless you were born rich or whatever. They didn't just suddenly wake up and they're in that position. Everyone has to go through their own journey to get to where they want to be in life.
Yeah, and it's a thing we don't see. And that was part of the tale, was that you don't see what these people did. You don't see how much effort they put into things, and it's important to remember that. And it's sort of like you have to put yourself back into your own shoes sometimes, because it's like you think, how many years have you done a certain job? And that's the thing for me, too. I mean, there were different – throughout my broadcasting career, I've been in it over 35 years, and there were periods where, well, I knew for the first several years of my life I wasn't going to be known at all. And it was very difficult to explain to my family that, you know, when they would say, well, you're not making much money, you know, you're working for a radio station nobody's ever heard of, you're in a very small market. And I said, well, this is how you do it. You pay your dues. You go a long time without being well known. And I've never been known, but it didn't matter because I was doing what I love doing, and I've seen it's just rises and falls in your career, you know. Are you satisfied so far, and are you ready to grow and go to the next thing? And that's what I try to ask myself is, okay, are you ready for the next step, right?
I'm trying to think of the best way to answer that. So I feel like everyone has to pay their dues or pay their time, because you don't suddenly become a superstar. You've also, to get to the top of any industry, you've got to learn your field. Let's say you've just started and we put you in front of maybe the biggest radio station in America or the biggest station in, say, Europe. If you were the first three, you would struggle. You wouldn't be ready. So that's why you need to prove yourself on a smaller audience. Then eventually you grow and grow, you get more comfortable, you learn your skills, and then eventually you're ready for a bigger platform. Because when you get more responsibility, you don't want to be in a situation whereby you get all these things and you don't know what to do. You want to be in a situation where actually you know how to handle it. Like, I remember when I made vice president in my firm back in 2015, and my role was changing that whole year. And then two of my former people who were in my position before left the firm. Suddenly I was just thrust into it. And that was an interesting situation because it was basically taking on a global role, something I've never really done before. And I really had to learn off my feet. It took maybe a few months before I really felt like this was my seat, this was my position. But eventually, there were certain meetings that took place, and that's when I felt like I took command of this role. And it was like, this is my yard and this is my territory now. Sometimes you do need to feel your way and grow into a role before you feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes when you're trying to step up in life, it doesn't matter what field it is, there's always going to be that initial uncomfort. But when you get over that, that's when you can really start to excel.
Yeah. And I think that's it. It's sometimes that happens. You get put into a situation and you draw on what you know. You draw on your own experience and you hope that you can adapt to that. And I think we've all been through it. It's like you come in with, you know, suddenly you've got a job that you don't know anything about, but it's like I've always found the same situation when I change, you know, when I go to another station or I go to a different studio and there's a completely different setup, but it's like, okay, you know enough. You know enough to know how to get started, and you can fall back in your experience on what's going to make this project work, what's going to make it sound right, and how are we going to set the mics up, and what are we going to do with the, you know, how are we going to account for this? And yeah, that's what it is. So it's like, this is, you know, Love, War, and Glory is also, to me, just like, it, you know, it's not exactly a how-to, but it certainly gives a few, I'm trying to find the right words. It's almost like a little guide. It's almost like a nice little set of guidelines that say, you don't have to do it just like this, but you have something here, right?
Say that again, please. The line cut for a moment there.
Sorry. The book is kind of like a set of guidelines, isn't it? Like a bit of help.
I would describe Love, War, and Glory as self-reflection of certain things that we all go through in life. I try to do it in a manner that it's meaningful. Can maybe to a certain degree, there's a little bit of a help guide for it. But it's more just about being able to relate one experiences, how maybe I overcame certain things, just trying to think what could have worked for you.
Mm-hmm. And I have one other question to ask about this before we move on. I watched a video of you giving a reading, and someone was shooting from the audience, and I was very interested in how you spoke and how you presented yourself. And what kind of reactions do you get when you read live? I just did a reading recently and played some music myself from my current book. And I try never to look too much at the audience, but I always sort of scan a little bit and see the reaction. Are they getting it? Are they feeling it? What kind of reactions do you get?
Overwhelmingly, when I've read out various things, people have been very positive. But I think what's interesting is what they respond to. Because depending on the audience, they may want different things. Like there's some of my audience, like there's one poetry event I did in Romford, which is basically 10 minutes from where I live. They were all responding to Glory. But there was a poetry event I went to, and they all wanted Love. Whereas other people were more interested in the life stories because of how it relates to certain things that happened in their life. So what I've found is that depending on the audience, depending on what the mood the audience is in the mood for, that can have an influence, not just in terms of reaction, but what you'll get the most reaction out of, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Yes, it does. Our guest today is Dennis Akinmobasire. He is the author of two books of Love, War, and Glory, Spoken Words for All Seasons. And I want to move now into your latest work, The Mission to End Slavery. Now, I write about time travel myself, so I was very intrigued immediately. You asked the question, sort of as a subtitle, what if slavery never existed? Tell us about what brought you to this project. What brought you in this direction?
Oh, it was interesting. Around about the start of 2019, I was in the mood to write a second book, partly because there were certain things going on in my life, but I wanted to take a crack at fiction because as much as I was proud of Love, War, and Glory, I felt that for whatever reason, poetry can be a very hard sell and it's very difficult to get people into poetry. So if you look at Amazon, if you look at the top 20 books, 18 of them are fiction, so there was that in mind in terms of being able to reach a wider variety of people. But then when I started to think about it, I said, well, what type of fiction do you want to write about? And at the time, I'd read a book called Why I No Longer Talk to White People About Race, and that got me thinking. It got me thinking about slavery and the impact it had on the world. And I said to myself, everyone talked about slavery, but no one's ever asked the question, well, what if slavery didn't exist? What about if all the key things that made slavery happen didn't occur? And then what about if my character basically had the ability to go back in time and stop the things from happening? And that's when the story was born. And I said, let's call it a mission. And that's when the title, The Mission to End Slavery, came about. So the way I describe Mission to End Slavery is the way to think of it is you've got, it's really slavery, action, adventure, and sci-fi to tell the ultimate what-if story. That's the way I've described the book.
Well, tell us about our protagonist, Femi. Who is he? What's he like, and how did he come about?
So Femi Adebayo, he's basically a regular East London kid, and he's Nigerian, from a Yoruba background. And the way he's grown up, he's always felt like he's had to fight against the system and thinks because he's black he's had to fight hard or work twice as hard just to be better than everyone else, just to give himself a chance. Then one time, after a conversation in a barber shop when they were arguing over reason why society's in a state today, he meets someone called Mr. Diggity, a mysterious being who offers him something seemingly impossible. He offers him the opportunity to go back in time to change the events that led to slavery. Femi dismisses him at first, but then an incident happens in his life, and then he took Mr. Diggity on his offer. And then it's a journey. He starts on a journey where he goes back to periods of time ranging from 15th century West Africa, the 18th century rebellion in 1800 in West Virginia. He goes back to Egypt to when Cleopatra and the Romans were about. He goes back to when slave ships. And it's really just that journey in time to see some of the key events that made slavery happening and thinking about what kind of world do we live in if those things didn't occur? It's a journey of self-discovery, because when he starts off, he's really a kid with no chance. And to take a mission like this, you have to really bring yourself up to be a warrior. So I almost thought back to one of my favorite films, Batman Begins, because when Bruce Wayne started on his journey, he started out with a mission and a purpose, but he needed guidance, he needed tools. He needs to basically channel himself into a weapon. And when Femi goes on his first mission to West Africa, the tribe that takes him in, they basically train him to be that and to teach him. Basically, they basically had to get the tools he was going to need to be successful in his mission. And that's why when he first starts, he sends them a year before some of the key events were happening to give him the time to learn the skills that he would need to be a success. And then through that, you see him growing as a warrior, as a leader, and being able to lead people into battle, and being able to, you know, be the man to make the difference in the end.
Okay. Now, one thing I must ask, we need to ask about, you know, the current tensions in the UK, but also here in the United States when it comes to race. Those are feeding into Femi's frustration with what he's seeing. How much of it have you experienced, do you see? Because when Femi is talking with his friends, you just feel this frustration. You just feel this anger that he has. And I think we've all felt at a time where, you know, we just feel like we're not getting anywhere. How closely have you seen it? How closely have you felt it? Because it seems to just fit. It fits into the book very nicely, but what do you see? What is your perspective on what you see for race relations and the concerns right now?
Honestly, you would think in this day and age, racism would no longer be an issue. But there's all sorts of life whereby, unfortunately, black people are still being let down. Black people are still not getting a fair crack with a whip. I'm going to give you an example. If I look at a sport close to my heart, football, or also known in the United States as soccer, there are certain top black players who, when they want to start off in management, they're having to start at teams such as Macclesfield, etc., whereas other people, like, I don't really want to mention the names, that have not had a coaching career, have barely done their badges, suddenly they're being given top jobs and being given the ability to access all sorts of things. And it's like, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain situations, certain sports, where they only trust you so far, but the moment they feel you're not needed, they'll cast you out like a leper.
Yeah.
And there were a few examples that I gave in my book.
Yeah. Well, that's a matter here in sports in this country is we have in you pick any sport. Some are a little better about it than others, but you see so few African Americans or non-whites as, say, general managers of teams. You know, the National Football League's gotten a little better at having African-American head coaches. And you're seeing more coaches. It seems like it's finally starting to change a little bit, but I see where you're going. You feel like you feel like certain guys, all of a sudden they're managing teams. And I could name a few, too, but I don't know if I would be fair or not completely. But, yeah, it's the same thing. It's like there's certain guys that just suddenly become, oh, you know, he's retired, so we're going to make him a coach. And it's like, okay, he probably can coach. He probably has some skills. He probably can impart experience, but you feel like, why that guy, right?
I'm trying to think how to process that. I think the only way we can really solve racism is we need to see human beings for what they are. And judging by their merits, not because they're cut out of their skin, and just give everyone an equal fair opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
That's one angle of it. And just going back to, you know, there are things that have happened whereby, I'm probably going to be touching a sensitive subject here, but there are certain nations out there, like Africa,
mm-hmm.
where we've been left behind because of certain things that happened in the Western world, and we're still suffering and paying catch-up. And we're not talking about 1 or 2 years. We're talking about almost hundreds of years catch-up in certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like the steps, you know, it feels like the steps are coming forward, but they're slow. It's like, and I agree, you know, it's like I want to see that the same way is, I mean, it was Martin Luther King who said that here of, you know, don't judge people by their skin color, judge them by their character, judge them by their content. And you hope for that.
I would like to think one day we will hopefully get there. But it may come when we're no longer around.
Well, that's the thing of, and Dr. King said that too. He said, I may not get to the mountain with you. And I write about it in Searching for Roy Buchanan. I have a brief area of examination of racism when our hero and her brothers travel to the Mississippi Delta in the 1930s and they experience racism, or they experience what their friends are dealing with, and it is an elderly character who just says, it won't happen in my lifetime, but one of these days it will. And, you know, she keeps the optimism and the positivity that one day it'll happen. And it's like, sadly, I won't be here to watch it, but I know it'll happen. You want to hope for that.
Sometimes in life, it's about making your mark. But sometimes that mark, or sometimes your impact, won't necessarily be felt by your lifetime. It might be felt by the people that come after you. Like, if I look at, say, someone like a Jesse Owens, when he won the four gold medals in the 1936 Olympics and basically went and, you know, stuck it to Hitler, that laid the foundation for other black athletes to come through and really start showcasing themselves. Because then, if you go to the 1984 Olympics, Carl Lewis went and did the same thing. Whereas if Jesse Owens hadn't paved the way for him to do that, Carl Lewis wouldn't have done it.
Exactly.
Sometimes it just takes one person to make a breakthrough in a particular field, and others think, if that person can do it, then so can I.
Right, right. To get back to your book, you mentioned Mr. Diggity. Who is this man, really, and what does he represent in the book?
Mr. Diggity is, he's one part mentor, one part a counter-argument, because every argument that Femi presents, Mr. Diggity often presents a counter-argument. Like, Femi often talks about the challenges that facing people from black origin. Mr. Diggity talks about people from Asia, people from other parts of the world that have also suffered and been affected by slavery. And he challenges, how come it's not held them back in certain instances, but why are black people being held up? So it does raise some interesting questions. And the other times he acts as a guide, because there are times when Femi might be in a dangerous situation. Mr. Diggity will show up to check in on him, to basically give him advice and see how he's approaching things, and also remind him of the mission and the terms of their agreement. I don't want to spoil it, but there's a certain chapter when Femi is considering making a certain decision. Mr. Diggity warns him, so says, hang on a minute, you are this close to finishing your mission, yet now you want to go and diverge. So he represents an interesting foil for Femi to bounce off.
Mm-hmm. Now, you chose some specific moments in history, and I confess I didn't know much about this one. The first one where Femi goes to Nigeria in the 15th century, and it's Chief Oko's battle against colonization. Can you give us a little bit of what kind of research did you have to do for these different scenarios? And this one in particular was fascinating to me.
I wanted to go and explore parts of slavery and parts and periods that no one ever heard of, or things you don't necessarily get taught in school. Like, you go back to the 15th century, when there was an invasion by the Portuguese. They came in, took a crop, and they started a slave trade in West Africa that led to a lot of things happening in terms of slavery from Africa. That's something that doesn't really get discussed. And I thought there was an interesting story, especially in terms of how the Yoruba tribe lived, especially in terms of how they prepared for themselves. So I felt that there'd be some interesting story points. So that was the reason why I picked that one. Nat Turner, one of the greatest slave rebellers, was very famous. Mm-hmm. Again, there was a story in the area that I felt wasn't really explored. Using the Friedenborg slave ship, because everyone knows there was a slave ship, but no one's ever talked about in detail in terms of, well, what was it like to be a slave on those ships and some of the horrors that people went through. And the chapter I think people found really interesting was going back to the Roman Empire. Well, we all learn about the Roman Empire at school, at least that's the case in the UK. But a lot of the origins of slavery were in the Roman Empire. And if you look at how people like Julius Caesar ran and governed themselves, he laid the foundation for some of the other despicable leaders that we've had to unfortunately come across in mankind's time. People like Adolf Hitler, Sterling, some really nasty people that were just out to basically get power at any cost. And I think Julius Caesar and the Roman Empire was the whole trigger point for a lot of that. And what I also found during that period, the Roman Empire took over a lot of people. There was only one empire that stood up against them, that was the Castringdom. And I found that a very interesting challenge, because it was almost like Castringdom was able to put them to a standstill. But what if they went further and took out the Roman Empire? That was, that was an interesting play on what happened in history and how that could have a ripple effect on time going forward.
Well, let's not give away the ending. I will say this, though. You took us to these places, and you have opened the door. I think we talked about it beforehand. This looks like a series, by the way you've let it hang a little bit. How far along, what do you envision for a series? How much more are we going to learn about Femi and his journey?
I see this as a two-parter. So I feel like this book is the first half. The second book, I think, is going to be the one that completes this story. So the first book is really what if slavery didn't exist. I won't give away the title of the second book, but the second book's going to be, the theme will be, what could be worse than slavery? So it deals with the outcome of some of Femi's actions. And you have to deal with the new, and Femi has to deal with the new world.
This just sounds like it has such elements of time travel, but it has elements of science fiction, and yet you've also given us a history lesson, so it's certainly well done, and I am interested in what will happen in part two for certain. We are talking with Dennis Akinmalasire, who has written, we're talking right now about his second book, the most recent, The Mission to End Slavery, and part two. How are you coming along with that, and when do you think we're going to see that?
I have a feeling that part two is a few years away, partly because I'm getting married this year in May. And there's also other things that I'm, thank you. And there's also other things that I need to do with my life at this point in time. At the moment, I'm trying to really promote book two, but it's been slow because my focus has been on the upcoming wedding. I expect to push a lot more with it after the wedding.
Right.
And then probably in terms of when part two will come, I think the earliest will be at some point in 2022 or maybe late 2021, depending on the time. How life is at that point in time.
All right. Very cool. Well, in the time we have left, Dennis, I'd like to ask a little about your personal history. Maybe you could tell us about your upbringing. And I've always found that how we grew up early in life certainly shapes our life, but it also shapes so many of the things that we do. Tell us about your growing up life, where, when, and all that.
Okay, so I was born in London. I'm from, my origin is Nigeria. And I grew up in East London, spent some time in Kent. So I was being, when I was living with my foster parents at the time, came back to London for full-time education when I was secondary school. Went to Nigeria when I was quite little. Then I came back when I was about 4 or 5. Didn't get the opportunity to go again until 2002. Then went back again in 2010 and 2015. I would say it's been an interesting upbringing. East London, especially if you look at the area where I'm from, Newham, which is known as one of the poorest boroughs in London. So there's always a certain stigma attached to it. And I feel like I've been lucky, because even though there have been challenges with our family, and sometimes we've had to go and make figure out our own way sometimes. I feel like I've been lucky that I've always had good people by my side. I've had my mum, my sisters. I've had good friends. I've had some of my friends. Most of my groomsmen, half of them are from my school days. So I've known them for more than 20 years. So I feel like what helps me is, be it from my school days, when I went to sixth form, university, work, when I've travelled around the world, I feel like I've always met good people, developed given me that experience, helped shape my thinking and shape my life going forwards. And now I'm probably at a point in time where I can probably give some of that back.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel it's important to help out the next generation.
That's cool. In terms of what you like to read, what were the people around you reading? What struck you early on in life for authors or for books, that kind of thing?
When I was younger, I used to like reading the Roald Dahl books, so things like Fantastic Mr. Fox. I like the I, Robot series of stories by Asimov.
Mm.
Things like Merchant of Venice were good to read. I found Charlotte to be a very interesting character. Then I went for a period, maybe because I was going to university studying, where I probably wrote a lot more textual books, especially in relation to my field, which is computer science.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's influenced me more in terms of my writing isn't necessarily the books I read as such. It's been more like my other interests, because I like science fiction and sci-fi. They're my favourite type of films. So the films I enjoy are things such as The Dark Knight, Batman Begins, Blade Runner, Star Wars, Black Panther left influence, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, Indiana Jones. What else in terms of the Color Purple? And I feel like the emotions that I felt those films evoked, that was what I tried to capture in my book, especially The Mission to End Slavery.
Yes, and that's very true, too. Films do the same thing. Music has done the same thing for me, is that because I just grew up around, I grew up in the 60s, so I grew up around when the Beatles were still incredibly popular, the Rolling Stones were hitting, and that's what my brothers listened to, so I got to hear all that, and music always just seemed to work for me, and yes, film I agree with as well, certain ones would get me, but I guess for me music was just the prime motivator, and it weaves its way in and out of my writing, it's what prompted me to pick up a guitar years ago when I was trying to look at, I'm looking at all the poetry I'd written, I'm thinking, these are actually songs, aren't they? And I just thought, let's see if we can make something out of them. So that's what really led me. That led me into writing when I would listen to music. And it was like, I find it remarkable that a 3-minute or 4-minute song sometimes would inspire something in me and say, there is a story that isn't being told, or I have one, and it fits. And it's fascinating how that happens.
I think with books, so like, well-written books are like an art form. Books can give you the ability to express your thoughts and express your creativity. Because the thing is, with a film, you can see it. But with a book, it's harder, because you've really got to be really descriptive in terms of communicating your thought process in terms of what you want people to hear from your story. So that's really powerful. And I feel like the best authors are the ones, be it whether you're writing a fiction book or a poetry book, they're the ones who are able to really bring the reader with you on that journey into your world and have them really rooting for the characters in question. If that makes any sense.
It sure does. It does. And do you see, I guess one of the last questions I have before I go to this is, do you see a mission for your writing in a bigger picture? Like, maybe it's answering the question, how do you want to be remembered, or how do you want your writing to be remembered?
Excellent question. So I think the thing that every author wants, so on one degree, everyone wants to be the next Stephen King, J.K. Rowling, really famous, sold millions of books. But especially in this day and market, obviously it's very hard to do that. It'd be nice to get a return on books. But I think the real thing that should be driving the author is, For every person that reads your book, if they're able to say, yes, they've understood the story, they've understood what you're getting at. It's not as if they don't necessarily like you, but it's about, are you connecting with what or where they were trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like for every book I write, for every person that reads it, if they come back and say to me, yes, I identify where you're coming from, I understand the points you're trying to make, your points resonate with me, that is probably the biggest reward I could get. Everything else in terms of what happens could be a bonus. Like, I could easily see the Mr. N. Slavery one day being the sort of book that ends up in a film. It has that potential.
Well then, how can we find your books and how do we find you?
Good question. So my website is www.akinsterbooks.co.uk. My books are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones. If you Google the Mr. N. Slavery, you'll find it. I also have an agreement for those of you that, which is probably not going to be as relevant here, but I also had an agreement with New Beacon Books. They're going to be selling my book. They're in the process of ordering some copies, so they're bookshop in North London. And actually, down the road, there'll be more establishments that pick up my book. I'm available on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, so I am reachable by those means as well.
All right. Well, this has been a great conversation. Thank you, Dennis, for your time. And, well, congrats again on your marriage, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Dennis Akinmolesire. He is the author of Love, War, and Glory, Spoken Words for All Seasons, and The Mission to End Slavery on Akinster Books. This is your host, Tori Gates, author of the current Brown Posey press release, Searching for Roy Buchanan, as well as A Moment in the Sun and Live from the Cafe. This is the Book Speak Network.